All right, Z-Pak. Well, I am very excited today because I am the chief medical officer of Athena Health, but none of that matters.
At all.
At all. He's an emergency physician.
Right.
His name is Kevin Bahn. I call him Bahn. It's actually pronounced Ban.
I like the Bahn.
It's Bahn because you're a Hungarian Jew by descent.
In fact, the name comes from my grandfather, whose last name was Bergel. But when he came across the United States, he took the name Bahn, which was actually his pen name.
He's
in
a
Hungary.
Writer.
He was a writer. So it should be pronounced Bahn. We're in America, so it's Ban. But it really should be Bergel. So it's it's a really complicated
Ban,
story.
Ban, Bahn, Bergel, potato, tomato, nuclear reactor. They're all on this
record. It's all good. I'm good today.
Man, what a pleasure to have you here. So there's a reason that you're here. Number one, you're in Vegas. And I was like, come be on the show.
Right.
But number next, as we say when we dictate, you're an emergency physician at Harvard for many years, now chief medical officer of Athena, and you are really interested in this idea that many people call burnout. I'm now starting to call moral injury among physicians and how we might be able to address it. Because both of us have been in that ringer. And actually, you've been all around the world doing it, actually, which we'll get to later. But this idea that, you know, the front lines of primary care are happening in the emergency department and that technology can either make that easier or harder and
right.
that all these regulations and all these rules that we have to satisfy to just do what we went into this to do, which is connect with fellow human beings, it just makes it an impossible task. And then we burn out, which is really we have this moral injury because we're not able to do the right thing for the patient.
Yeah, in a really complicated system where it happens day in and day out, where you know you're trying to do the right thing, but you're overwhelmed by the system. I think when I was training back in the early 2000s, there were about 80 million emergency department visits per year. Now there are like 140 million. And this is not just about the ED, this is about everyone who's impacted by that. The inpatient side, the specialists, the surgeons, everyone.
Dude, we thought it was busy back then because I trained the same time you did.
Oh, yeah.
We thought it was busy then. We started instituting CAPS. We were the one year before the CAPS went in where
yeah.
you had to, and we were like, this is unsustainable.
Totally.
And now it's vastly worse. Unsustainable.
I was talking to a buddy over the weekend, a guy who I trained with. He's the director of a community emergency department in Massachusetts. I believe it might have the highest volume in the state. They see over 100,000 patients every year, okay?
Wow.
He's got like 60 beds, and last week when he was working clinically, he went in to do an overnight, and there were 70 boarders. So 70 people waiting for a bed, plus he's trying to run 60 rooms. Like, imagine that, sort of day in and day out, and all the paper cuts. I like the way you frame it, moral injury, and I'm kind of familiar with that term.
Yeah.
Because it's a complicated problem, and I know I'm here, you know, Chief Medical Officer at Athena Health, and we have to think about the electronic health record and the role it plays, but it's much more complex than that. You could fix the EMR problem tomorrow, and you wouldn't fix the problem.
You know, you nailed it. The EMR is just a symptom, because what the EMR is doing is it's complying with this already jacked up system.
And
that's then, it. And it's helping us to comply with a jacked up system. But we know that the system's jacked up, at least unconsciously. You know what's interesting? I don't think it's a conscious knowledge anymore because people have been conditioned to just accept this matrix that we live in.
Yes.
Right? They don't see the matrix. You give
right.
them the red pill. Like, for example, let them work in like the kind of clinic we built, Turntable Health, or one of
right.
our Auris clinics, or a direct primary care clinic, or a really advanced, you know, foreign hospital, something like that. And they will see, oh, you can actually just take care of patients, do the right thing for the patient, and do well financially. That's a big deal. Well, then the moral conflict is gone.
Yes.
The conflict is...
And the feeling is completely different, right, to those people, because they're really connected to the reason why they went into healthcare, right? I'm thinking right away, like, most of what, when you think about the electronic health record, most of what's soul-sucking, gut-wrenching, is the stuff around, you know, clicking these boxes and doing all this documentation for government programs or payer programs that don't really correlate with care, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And with quality.
Yeah.
And so that just, it day in and day out, is mind-numbing to people. Take that away, and all of a sudden, they're just thinking about the reason why they went into healthcare and connecting with their patients, and it feels different.
You know, I like to think of it in terms of, like, what was the best shift you had or the best day you had? Remember back to that. What was happening? Okay, the system was down. I couldn't chart, so I just had to talk to patients. I spent
yeah.
time with them, or I had fewer patients that day for some glitch in the matrix, and so I was able to sit and spend time, really connect with the team was there, and they were learning, and we were teaching each other, and everybody was firing on all cylinders in this team, and I felt deeply connected, not just to my patient, but but to my colleagues and to my purpose all at once. And I left energized, ready to work even harder. Like, that's the thing. They think we're don't want to work.
Right. That's the paradox, is that it's not that you necessarily want to work less. And what's interesting is that even 50% of physicians who say that they're burned out still feel fulfilled in terms of the interactions they're having with their patients, right? So this is not about, like, just wanting to, like, check out and be done with it. It's wanting to do the things that you think are high value and the things that matter to you. You asked me the question, that reflect back on that shift. One of the things I did was, I'm an early adopter. I'm one of those people, like, I give it to me, I'll give it a shot. We started talking about scribes. So I was one of the people, like, give me a scribe. It was the best thing that I ever did. Like, I'm pretty convinced, I don't know a provider who wants to have an electronic health record in their life. I mean, we have to figure out a way, and we can talk about this, you know, to make the electronic health record be something that puts wind in the sails and not something that prevents you from working. But that scribe allowed me to do the stuff that I thought I should be doing as an academic doctor. Like what? Well, taking care of patients and communicating with their families. Talking to the paramedics. Teaching the residents.
Wait. You talk to the paramedics?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Who are you, man? Come on.
I'm such an aberration.
So many of our fans are paramedics, and they're like, no one talks to us, no one listens to us, they don't take us seriously.
Huge
we do
mistake.
All this work. Yeah.
But it's a real one. At Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, we had to work on that. Literally say, as trauma patients were being brought in, allow the patient to die for 15 seconds, okay? So that you can listen to the paramedics. Uh-huh. Like, we would not allow anyone to put hands on the patient until report was taken.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that important.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I learned having the scribe was that I was focusing now on all the things that I wanted to be doing, right? And I would end my shift feeling pretty fulfilled. Look, there's always good days and bad days, but I felt like I was doing the thing that I was there to do, and I didn't have 2 hours of charting like I did, you know, every other shift before the scribe.
So, well, and a good parallel to that is the old academic practice, like I used to have, where the residents would write the notes. You would just be present.
Oh, yeah.
Present for the team, present for the patient, present there.
Yeah. Agree with above.
You can't do it anymore.
Great
days, because you got to be present with the patient and form those connections. That yesterday I did this rant for my show where I was like, okay, why the hell do we have this show? Why do we have this movement? What is the heart of it? The heart of it is love. And then you sound spooky. But what is love? It's a connection between human beings. We've broken the connection. That's why the scribe, it sounds like, allowed you to
reconnect.
Reconnect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that that was apparent to everyone. I was seeing patients more safely. Teaching scores went up. Patient status. I mean, all that stuff comes together.
Right.
So I'm a big believer that we have to think about resources and tools that can help us kind of get there.
So this idea of tools and things, but before we go down that path, I want to say one objection. So, you know, the people at Kaiser will say, well, we looked at scribes and it didn't make them, it didn't make the doctors any more efficient.
Oh, it doesn't. Oh, no, I get that 100%.
Tell me about that, yeah.
Well, because what most people do when they're busy seeing patients is they continue to see patients and they do the documentation later.
Right.
So I was finishing every shift and, you know, I would try to get my charts done just because that's what I wanted to do. And I was spending 2 to sometimes 3 hours after my shift doing that. So I wasn't seeing less patients.
Right.
I just wasn't documenting during
the visit. Yeah.
And so what happens then when in the alpha phase of that, when the department was paying for it, it was all good because they were paying for it and we were seeing what the deal was, but I wasn't seeing more patients. They would say things like, well, you need to see about 1 to maybe 2 more patients a shift to justify the cost of the scribe. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't seeing 1 to 2 more patients per shift because, you know, what I was doing was not documenting 2.5 hours after. What I was doing was connecting wholly during the shift, but I wasn't doing more from an RVU or a financial status. Does that make sense?
100%.
But I chose anyway to continue to pay for the scribe because I thought it was that powerful.
So all these things are little symptoms and little pieces of a potential solution. But what's interesting is one thing you said, which is now you're present with the patient during the visit. And in emergency medicine, that's crucial because you're looking at body language, you're reading cues, you're getting the smells and the sights and the sounds.
Yeah.
And I remember doing this very clearly. If you have a chart open with you and you're typing and you're talking to the patient, your mind is absolutely split. You cannot multitask. It is movement of attention back and forth, which means your attention is never focused. It's always darting back and forth. Mm-hmm. So to be able to solve that, in my mind, you'd have to study it, but it seems to me like it would lead to better satisfaction, better outcomes, and lower costs long run, even though you're not seeing more patients. Do you agree, or do you think that's crazy?
No, I think that that's right. But I don't think that that's how the system is set up right now, right? So I was personally on a P&L system, right? So I needed to see a certain number of patients to justify my salary, and that in general cuts across all of the system when you're talking about fee for service. So when you talk about moral injury, it's I like that concept because this is a really complex problem that's multifactorial. Like I said, you know, we can get rid of the electronic health record and we still have the problem. So there are different things that we need to do, and part of that is thinking about the way in which healthcare works and the system in which we're working. I think value-based care is trying to do that. It's just going way too slow.
It's slow, yeah. And even the concept, you know, we have all the catchphrases, value-based care, and you know, what does it really mean? It means doing good for the patient means doing well financially. That's value.
Yeah.
And meaning providing the best quality at the lowest cost with the best convenience and experience.
Sure.
That's quality. But one factor that often is not in that, and that's what I liked about, you know, kind of working with the folks at Athena, that's the reason we've work with you on music videos and things like that in the past, is that you guys actually care about the physician and the nurses and the frontline staff, you know, because you were founded by someone who was a paramedic. And so this idea that there's a fourth component, which is staff satisfaction, caregiver satisfaction. And it's not, satisfaction sounds very trite. It's our connection to our purpose and our patients. Is that being facilitated?
Right.
And you're right, you could get rid of the technology and you would still have the problem because we're incentivized incorrectly, the value stuff isn't here yet. Mm-hmm. We have this fragmented Byzantine system that is still has relics of the 20th century in terms of this cowboy autonomy, mm-hmm. but is trying to homogenize everything in a new way that it's also wrong.
Yeah.
So what has to transcend is this sort of 3.0 vision.
You know, we've been working on this at Athena, and we've just taken concepts from outside of healthcare, which is a good place to start maybe, and talked about capability. So what does it take for a physician to feel capable? Now, I don't love the term because for a physician, if I say capable, a lot of times they're thinking fund of knowledge, what am I capable? And that's not exactly what we mean by it. It really breaks down into three different things. You know, we're talking about, do you have the resources to get your job done? Do you have the tools to get the job done? And then the third piece of it is, do you have the latitude? And as you start to frame it like that, it gets interesting, right? All of a sudden, it becomes actionable in a way. And then we follow that up even with another survey that we did across Hippocrates, which is kind of the beauty of
Athena. So you guys own Hippocrates?
We do, yeah,
dude,
we do. Not only are we single instance in terms of this network, the, you know, AthenaNet that we've built, but we also have Hippocrates where we connect with physicians, and that's a big deal.
At what time is AthenaNet going to go sentient and destroy humanity? It sounds like something...
It's happening right now.
Yeah, that's right. Speak. It was 2018.
I'm distracting you. As it's happening.
I'm like, I thought I smelled nuclear missiles launching.
That's us taking over.
I knew it. Congratulations, man. You
feels
beat
good.
The AI.
Feels really
it
good.
Does feel good to destroy humanity. Now, getting back to the humanity piece, it's interesting because when you talk about capability, you're talking about tools, resources, and latitude. Now, latitude, I use the word autonomy. You guys are big nerds.
Yeah, I like autonomy.
Autonomy is good, but it's all semantics. But what's interesting is you guys were studying this, and me and Jessica Sweeney Plath did a show about this actually at your headquarters a while back, because I was very compelled by this idea. And then I went back recently, and I was looking through my writing on my website about Health 3.0. Mm-hmm. And I talk about Health 1.0, this old cottage industry, Health 2.0, the matrix that we're living in now, and Health 3.0. And what I said, there was a line in there, and this was years ago that I wrote this. Again, we reclaim the humanity and the repersonalization of medicine by having the tools, resources, and autonomy.
Did you really write that?
I actually wrote that to care for our patients. Yeah. And so when I heard you were going to be in town, I was like, you know, this connection means that the most brilliant mind in medicine, okay, thought of this already, which means...
that's you. Okay. No, that was...
No, it's actually Dr. Oz. It's Dr. Oz. but this idea that then these things converge, it's not just business speak.
Right.
It actually, from people on the front lines, this is how it feels. If we had, and let's dig into a little. So what do you mean by resources?
You know, so let's take something like loneliness, okay? Something that people are talking about more and more,
We had Vivek Murthy on the show, former Surgeon General, talking about loneliness.
Yeah.
It's his passion project now.
Yeah, it's a really big deal. There are people like Sachin Jain out at Caremore in California that are really interested in it. There are a lot of people who are interested in it. But if you're a physician sitting in front of a patient and you're concerned that maybe loneliness plays a part of this, but you have no resources by which you could impact that, would you ask the question?
No.
No. I'll tell you right now, a provider will never ask a question that they don't feel like they can act on. Mm-hmm. My example is I started off, I matched in urology, and I did 2 years of general surgery, 6 months of urology.
You got to have a good sense of humor for urology, man.
Oh, it's good. It's great stuff.
That's, did I ever tell you about the song I wanted to do?
Urology-based?
Yeah, it was about, ooh, I'm a rebel just for kicks now. But it was going to be, ooh, I'm a doctor just for... Now, I had to bleep it out because it's a family show.
Yeah, that's. But it's good. I like where you're going with that.
I'm glad you did.
You might have a future in this.
You know what?
Mama says so. During my residency, it was right around the time that Viagra came out. And you would never have asked about erectile dysfunction before because there really wasn't much to do about it. But now all of a sudden there's this little pill. And we were like, you know, hey, any more questions before we finish our visit? And they'd be like, well, no. And then you'd bring up the topic and you'd see them sort of get interested. But you felt kind of empowered because there was this resource, a medication, that could actually fix a problem. That's a big problem, right?
You know, and funnily enough, now that you're asking all these questions, now we have an epidemic of nursing home syphilis and gonorrhea. So you're welcome.
You have to be careful because you can take this pill. It might cause a heart attack, but that's a pretty good way to die.
It's a good way to go out. No, but you're right. Go ahead.
That whole concept of having to have the resources, whether it's for loneliness, transportation's a big deal. All these different things that are really now being called social determinants of health. I'm becoming wary of that.
Yeah, tell me. Because I use it a lot, and I feel a little bit weird about it because it's more than that. It's just these are our patients' lives. What is the social determinants of health? This is their life, and here's the tiny piece of it that intersects us.
And I hope, too, that it's not being used to say something about our patients about their
social
poor.
Status.
Exactly.
Yeah. Racial status.
That's where I get a little bit concerned. Yeah, we should just say what it is. But these are the social aspects that get in the way of us taking good care of our patients.
Right.
I spent 8 years in Italy on behalf of Harvard. I know, tough
what
job.
What a light guy, you guys.
Great gig.
Ivory Tower buttheads.
Yes.
go to Italy.
Yeah. And live in Florence.
Florence, my favorite city in the world. And you go and live there.
Yeah. I'm married to a woman from Florence. Both of my kids are born there. It's like, I know. It's more and more infuriating as...
I'm so angry right now. You know, it's like...
You're fuming inside.
If I were Bruce Banner, already like green veins would be popping out.
And Doc Vader's going to pop out and...
Don't let me forget to talk about the Doc Vader index.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, yeah, we have to talk about
that. Yeah.
But what was interesting while I was there was really appreciating how much emphasis they put onto the social aspects. You know, that's the 80%, 20%, and we've got it
backwards.
Flipped where everything has to be medicalized when they're really social issues. And I think we're gaining appreciation, and like anything, you have to, the first step in solving a problem is saying, hey, we got a problem.
Right.
Let's solve the problem.
Right. Could you imagine America going to a 12-step program? Hi, I'm America, and I'm a social determinants of healthaholic. I have a sponsor. I believe in a higher power. His name is Gozer the Gozerian.
You're pretty good at this.
You know, no formal training.
Yeah.
You were in media too. Didn't you do some reporting?
Oh, you're going way back. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe I can teach you something about medical communication. Is that
how would? Yeah.
That's a joke. You know that. That's a joke.
I'm not sure it is because I want to see how would you start a show. As a reporter, because you did medical reporting in Boston, right? Do your voice.
That's not the only thing. Now, this is my joke voice about doing
that. I like the joke.
I did medical reporting, you're right. A couple of years in New York City and then 3 years in Boston while I was doing my residency, which was a fun thing to do and cool, and brought in a little extra cash so that I could date my girlfriend
Italian.
Who was in Italy.
So you're basically the Anthony Bourdain minus, you know, severe depression, you know, that I can tell anyways. But yeah, so tell me more about Italy.
You know, I think that was my first, you know, humbling experience ultimately, because, you know, we went there in our typical American maybe / Harvard way. We were making fun of things that they were doing and things that we now do. and I don't think it sunk in immediately, but I saw what it looked like to think about population health management, to use a term.
To use the,
And I came back from Italy after 8 years. I was back and forth And tried to make sense of that and got closer and closer to population health management, which is actually how I got over to Athena, which was doing population health management.
Oh, because you were working on that. Athena was like, we're trying to do better on that angle. And
Yeah, they're trying to build that out. And for me, it was a great experience because I got outside of Boston.
Right.
All of us are victim to being sort of homegrown.
The ivory tower. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was that way at Stanford. Yeah.
And it's a good idea to get out of it. And so I've had the pleasure of working with large organizations, on the West Coast and small organizations in Western North Carolina that do like really great work, who are actually executing on the stuff that we were talking about, but never really quite getting done.
Interesting.
So well, it's been a great experience.
Have you ever had to set up an East Coast, West Coast rap battle? Because I was just listening to California Knows How to Party, Knows How to Party with Dr. Dre and Tupac. And he said some really inflammatory things about the East Coast that
I'm upset about that.
You should be.
And I feel like I want to act on that, but I don't really know how to. So maybe you can help me with that.
Let me help you. Think of these rap battle feuds as kind of like in the old days, D'Artagnan, you take a white glove and you slap someone off the face.
Yes.
Now you just fill them full of bullet holes and then claim to, have been with their girlfriend. That's apparently
strikes me as extreme. I like the glove.
It's
somewhat extreme.
It does ramp it up. There's a template. It's a formula.
you need to gradually get to the point where you're filling someone with bullets and.
Yeah. You don't go zero to bullets in like 5 seconds. You start with, there's a little beef, and then you put out a track.
Yep.
California knows how to party. And then maybe North Carolina.
That would really piss people off.
It would anger the North Carolinians, who would then say, but East Side is the Yeast Side, or whatever their slogan is.
Right.
Probably don't go with East Side is the Yeast Side.
It doesn't feel like the right one, but we're iterating here.
We're iterating. This is a process.
Yeah.
That's what I like about it. So back to population health. When you looked at this, now here's a question. So when you went to Athena, I'm intellectually curious about this. Did you start as chief medical officer, or did you have to stab your way to the top?
No. No, I just went to Athena. I went to Athena because I thought that there was an opportunity to do something that I was really interested in every day.
Yeah.
And so I went there to lead the build out the population health team. So I was not the chief medical officer at that time.
Got it. But then you killed the chief medical officer and were able to just slide in.
Well, we got into a rap.
A rap, yeah, too, a little
and,
beef.
And then all
right,
that
right.
happened.
It was like a Drake.
No, that didn't happen either, but no one will believe that.
So. I'm curious because a lot of doctors are looking to do other things, right?
Yeah.
Because of this, they don't feel capable in their job to take care of patients. So they're like, well, maybe I can fix the system. Are you hopeful that that is doable? Like working in a company, can you actually move the dial on making doctors feel like they have better resources, better tools, and better autonomy?
Yeah, I think things have gotten significantly, the conversation has really moved along quite a bit. Mm. It kind of feels like we're like puttering along and maybe it's just me being an optimist, but I kind of feel like there's an inflection point. There's this tip, Malcolm Gladwell's tipping point that we're going to hit. I think we have been struggling with all this government regulation. I mean, the Obama years put a lot of regulation on, and some of that was necessary and well-intentioned, but got sort of sideways on us to a certain extent. I don't think we're going to see a lot of that in the next couple of years, and it's a good time for us to kind of figure out what matters. Yeah. I think that's what we're trying to do too. There's like no widget for an electronic health record that's going to fix your problem. So we're trying to understand the problem. That's why we're doing this research around capability and trying to understand burnout, which is something that we've gotten a little bit closer to. And I'm hopeful that as leadership recognizes it as a problem, it'll do something to impact it and do something meaningful. I'm not talking about, mindfulness and meditation.
Yeah.
And I believe in all those things.
Yeah, those things are great.
I'm raised by kind of a hippie freak who got us going on transcendental meditation. I think when I was 9 years old, I do yoga. I love all that.
I'm with you, brother.
But I don't think that's going to solve the problem, right? And I think that we have to understand that there are a bunch of different elements, and it starts with leadership, and it starts with the communication, real communication with the folks at the front line, and then acting on those things in a way that makes their lives different. I would start there before the EHR, although the EHR is something we should focus on.
Yeah, you said a lot of stuff that I want to cheer for. One is that we're at a tipping point, yes.
I hope so.
We're at a tipping point. And this is part of the reason we even do our show, is that we're sensing this tipping point. Just on this Facebook channel, there's 1.1 million healthcare people.
What?
Yeah, I know. You're famous. You're already famous. Back to you, Bob. I'm Kevin Ban. Should be pronounced Bon, but also Burgle. No, but this idea that things have gotten so bad, and now we do, you're right, the regulatory, there's a regulatory gap now where we know we're not going to get new regulations for a period, so we can start to figure out what matters and then create a better way of doing things. And whether that's starting by fixing these ideas of moral injury through providing better resources, so now we have better support maybe, better tools, better EHR, better diagnostic software, better AI that informs us. And again, these are catchphrases, but better population health.
Yeah, but I think those that matters. You know, we've been dumping information into this electronic health record, which is probably just a glorified billing.
Wait a minute, stop. You're the chief medical officer of a major EMR company, and you just said it's a glorified billing platform.
Well, that's where it started.
Yeah.
I mean, let's stop for a second and say, what if it had not been about billing? What if it had been about trying to help doctors be more efficient, effective, productive? What if it had been about taking better care of patients in such a way that they were really connected and engaged, and so were the physicians, and that would all result in better outcomes and physicians not being so burned out? What would it look like? It might look more like Amazon with apps.
Yeah.
Right? And you could be like, yeah, I like that app, but, you know, I want this one, I want that one.
The urology app.
Yeah. I want the app that listens to me while I'm in the room with my patient, that exists, right? That stuff is out there. We have that in our marketplace. You know, you could choose that and build something that would help you engage better with your patients and drive better outcomes. That's not what happened. But it might have looked like that had that been the true north up front, right?
Ah, so can we get there?
So it's hard, right? Because now you've sort of built something. There's all this legacy stuff behind it. We've got really talented, smart people who are deeply committed to making healthcare better, you know, unbreaking healthcare and letting doctors be doctors, right? It's a really cool concept. And there are times we're working on meaningful use certification when they'd rather be doing the things that I just mentioned that will actually help you take better care of your patients, right? So it's hard when you start in a certain place and then you try to move it, but we have to move it. And I think we're starting to see that. You know, this is a time when interoperability, integration might be possible. There are moments where I feel like, has that failed? And we should rely on patients to do that, right? Like, should we be putting more power into the hands of the patient so that they can do their job?
Give them a thumb drive with all their information and...
Or something even, you know, more tech-savvy.
Don't use thumb drives anymore? What? I go to conferences, they give me thumb drives all the time.
You know, but I think about the role of the patient and how complicated and difficult it is. Mm. Like, you know this.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, I get the call all the time, which is sometimes about healthcare or, you know, making a diagnosis or treatment, but more frequently is about navigating an impossible system.
Yeah.
If you are sick, if you have chronic medical problems in this country, it's a full-time job, and yet you have no tools, right?
No
tools. What if we did that, right? And what if doctors got on board with engaging their patients in that way? Mm. What would that look like?
So. You know, I think that's the key way, and that's why I think clinical leadership matters. So as a doctor, now you're leading, and you can actually make a difference. And I think we're missing that in a lot of aspects of the world. So I had a call, and I don't even know if I should talk about this, but I'm going to, because I no longer care.
We are so out of the box
right
now.
Out of the box.
Man, it's like, I'm not sure how I feel about this whole thing.
No, you should feel very good, because this honesty is what people want to hear. And so I had a call with Epic, their PR people. Because they were upset with me because of my rants and ravings about how the electronic medical record, and by the way, why am I not calling it a CHR, was one of their complaints, comprehensive health record. Well, when you make it comprehensive and health, then I'll call it that. Until then, I won't.
Yeah.
They felt like I wasn't doing justice to the fact that there are good people working very hard to make it better, and that they do involve doctors and they do involve clinicians. And one of the things they said was, well, we've built this Maslow's pyramid, and we've spent all this time and energy and money building the bottom of the pyramid, which is making the chart, electronic chart, do as much as what paper used to do.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're at a point where we can create poetry and meaning and purpose. And I'm like, I started using EHRs in the form of Epic in 2002.
Oh, is that right? Is that you?
Yeah.
Oh, right. You were
Palo
at
Palo Alto Medical Foundation, Stanford. I was there the night it went live. and it changed my life for good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And you started to see exactly, because we went from just like being able to look at our patients in the eye, and actually our notes were short because we didn't want to get writer's cramp. And now it was like copy, paste, click, copy, paste, click, yeah. Stare at computer, go home, chart for 3 hours, pajama time, destroyed. So I said, so it's taken how many decades now to get the bottom of the pyramid? But I don't see that transcending until you blow up the bottom of the pyramid, yeah. And really do something unique. Maybe it's a model where it's apps. Maybe it's a model where the whole incentive structure has changed. Because, you know, your question is one we should be asking. What if we had built it from the beginning instead of a billing and compliance platform, which had to be done?
Yeah.
I don't blame any company for...
Yeah, that could have been an element of what it was about.
Right.
Right. But what if we had built it to be something different where that was a part of it?
Correct. And I love this idea of, like, there's a app that will listen to you during the visit,
yeah.
Transcribe it, and populate a chart note. Like, think about nursing. Okay, is this something we forget? I don't think you forget it because you deal with nurses.
And I'm still seeing patients, so I've decided to stay connected.
Yeah.
And it informs this conversation for me still.
And me too. So when I see patients at our county hospital, you know, I'm watching the residents holding their iPads and just click, 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 click.
Right.
And sometimes they'll say things like, well, you know, the patient says this, but in Epic, it was documented this, so I'm gonna believe Epic. And you're like, and Epic is shorthand for whatever EHR we're using, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is not about Epic.
No, it's not.
Everyone's struggling with the same stuff.
It's like, you know, saying Pampers for diapers, you know? I'm just saying, the chart.
I think I hate that, but yes.
And a Band-Aid, right? So, you know, in that setting, still seeing patients is crucial for physician leadership, because I think otherwise you definitely start to detach. You know, one of the worst things that I had to do was run Turntable Health without seeing patients in Turntable Health.
I think I made the assumption that you were seeing patients.
Not there. I would see patients in our hospital, and if our patients ended up in the hospital. But the thing is, because we were partnered with Iora, they hired the physicians, and they were under their malpractice, and this and this and this, and they wanted to keep it very cohesive, because then I would have had to go to all the Iora training sessions and the thing. And so they were like, we don't need you in the clinic. And I was like, but. And so.
No, go to your office. You're an administrator.
You're an administrator,
yeah.
Right? And that was one of the most hard.
Now I think about that when you did the Doc Vader with the administrator, which is one of my favorite ones. You're like that woman sitting there across the table.
I am.
Yeah.
I would meet with the docs, and I'd be like, so the thing is, we need to basically get more patients here so we can make it sustainable, which means we're gonna have to figure out. And they would say, well, here's the issue. These patients have all different insurances, and we have our homegrown EHR that doesn't bill insurance. And so now we're out of network for this patient who's paying out of pocket, but we're in network for this insurance company that's paying our membership fee and this. And it takes us all day just to get through that. I thought we were supposed to be looking at patients in the eye, and I'm like, okay, we need to fix that. So we need to narrow down our patient population. Well, you narrow down the patient population, then what happens? You can't fund the overhead. And so I would go to bed at night just in a panic, waking up in a cold sweat at 2 a.m,
right.
Going, this is going to fail. And it did. And the biggest relief in my life was the day we finally closed. Because I'm like, I don't have to be an administrator.
Because it must have been.
It was hard. And again, I'm acting like, oh, woe is me. I had to be an administrator, Kevin. But the truth is, I went from hating administrators and feeling like they were the enemy to really feeling a deep compassion, because they're trying their best in a broken system.
Oh, I agree with that. I agree with that wholeheartedly. When I came back from Italy, I became chief medical officer within the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center system in one of the community hospitals. So I found myself in a very similar situation that you're in, like having a deep respect for the people at the front line and what they were trying to do, mm-hmm. and yet feeling all the pressures of like, yeah, but we've got to get that catheter out of the bladder. Like, I was like, can we not get a catheter out of the bladder or document why in the first 24 hours? Can that not happen? And the answer is, like, that is such a complex issue,
yeah.
Right? And I felt very sort of squeezed by that, for sure. I think one of the things you said earlier, though, is it matters that we have clinical people in leadership. You know, we should not allow this new chapter, this you're calling it 3.0, this should not happen in the absence of people who take care of patients and understand what that means being a big part of it. And so I think that there's great hope, but it means people have to figure it out. And it doesn't need to be leaving and going to something altogether new and different. It could simply mean being sensitized, believing that this is the right thing to do, and then trying to make some small change where you are. I actually like that quite a bit. And I become a lightning rod for people who think that maybe they want to leave clinical practice. Mm. Because they're like, well, you know, Kevin did something different, you know? Mm. And my advice frequently is, you know, the place where you are needs to have transformative change. Be a part of that.
Start there. Yeah. That's what I tell the ZPAC, although I've started to modify it by saying, but if you feel like you're absolutely powerless, in other words, everything you've tried has failed, and you're running up against walls, walk to a different system.
Yes.
And because anyone who tells you you're not employable is lying to you.
Well, I agree with that too. If you try where you are.
Yeah, and, but you ought to try.
You ought to try. And the truth is that, you know, when I think about something like burnout in our survey, when we asked, you know, in the last 12 months, what percentage of the hospital systems actually tried to do something.
Yeah.
I think it was 72% of the hospitals had done nothing.
Yeah.
And so if you feel like you're in a place like that, that is just not interested and just wants to churn and burn, then I understand. And then you're going to need to move towards like-minded people and be at a place where you feel like you can contribute, right? So I get that. But there's the 28%, right? There's the 28% of the hospitals that are trying to do something and they need help getting it done.
Yeah.
Be a part of that if you can.
Yeah, absolutely, man, absolutely. And the other thing is, I think we need to stop shaming clinicians who decide to go into these leadership roles. Have you noticed that's a thing?
So, oh yeah, totally.
You know, oh, you don't see patients anymore. Well, actually I do. I don't see them all day, every day, because if I did, I wouldn't be able to come up for air enough to do what I'm trying to do. And you need us in leadership. You need more of us in leadership. And so stop shaming. Stop eating our own.
Yeah.
You know, because would you rather than have an MBA who, you know, Harvard MBA doing it? Because they will screw it up. They haven't touched patients.
Right.
They need us. We need them too.
Yep.
But it's a partnership. So let's stop, you know. And we were talking about Doc Vader and the healthcare administrator.
Yeah.
So it's funny because we did a podcast earlier that hasn't been released yet, I don't think, but
no, it's coming out.
It's coming out.
Next couple of weeks.
And you and I developed a new quality
measure. I actually have to say that it was Jessica Sweeney Platt.
That's
JSP.
Right. JSP did it.
It would be wrong for me to say that was me. It was a brilliant idea of how Doc Vader, actually I thought about it after and it was so depressing, but Doc Vader resonates. And I think a joke isn't funny unless there's a moment of truth in it.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, it's just it's absurdity, right?
Yeah.
And so Doc Vader is connecting to the ZPAC. ZPAC?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they're right.
And don't let Pfizer sue me over that. It's not a drug, people.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is a drug.
It can be a drug.
Yeah, that's right.
But you know, people are connecting with that. And so if there were an index, I think Jess suggested, we could say like, hey, the ZPAC or the Doc Vader index,
the DVI
dropped. Because people are more engaged and people are enjoying what they're doing. And people are like, that's just crazy. What's he talking about? The problem is people get it and people are connecting to it. And that's kind of depressing.
You know, I've always said I have a love-hate relationship with my creation, Doc Vader.
Is that true?
Absolutely. Because in many ways, I find him to be the repulsive sort of voice of all that is wrong. And he doesn't have solutions. His solutions are lightsaber the hell out of everything. But he's got plenty of complaints. So if he sits there and he's talking to the administrator and he's like, every day it's like the emperor put a lightsaber in my buttocks. Every day. I try
to.
It's right in the cleft. Right in the gluteal cleft.
Yeah, it was very.
And every day. And that gets 11 million views. Now, that tells me that the DVI, the Doc Vader index, is very high. It means that people are resonating with a message that says that something's broken. Now, that's wonderful if we're raising awareness to actually change it. If we're just complaining, it's a sad expression of how broken we are.
Yeah.
So I have this love-hate. So now I kind of use it more as like, let's do something absurd. But let's have this bigger conversation like you and I are having about how do we actually work to make it better? And people you might think are not on your side, like someone from an EMR company, are actually deeply on your side.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
I mean, not only on your side, they're you.
They're you.
They're you.
They care. They want it to be better. All the people in the company want it to be better.
Want it to be better, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that that matters a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who have said, I will only work for physician-led organizations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people can get that. I think a lot of times it happens through partnership, too.
Yeah.
You're seeing that more and more. Because the truth is, we're just not trained in some ways to deal with some of the business aspects. And so partnership where you have like this dual, or they call it a dyad concept,
yeah.
where you might have an administrator coupled with a physician leader can work. But the voice needs to be there. And I hope that it won't get lost because we shame one another. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I think it's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm probably seemingly biased in this, but we ought not shame the people who want to be a part of leading what the future ought to look like. We don't need to be managed. We're smart people, right?
Yeah, and that's the central premise.
Right, like we would have figured this thing out.
That's why managed care never worked.
Yeah.
Because who was managing us? One doctors, you know?
And I think that is sometimes where there's a total disconnect.
Yeah.
I have a buddy who's a orthopedic surgeon, went to medical school with him.
Does he have guns? Is he just yoked?
He was probably at one point in his life.
Does he wear like the cutoff scrubs?
Oh my gosh.
Sorry, I'm.
He would have. He definitely would. Oh gosh. You kind of get right to who he is.
Who he is.
I almost said his name.
I mean,
but
you
I won't
said
do
ortho,
that.
It's all it takes, but please continue.
Great guy, and you know, he's working in a hospital and he's doing ortho trauma.
Mm.
So, really difficult, you know, work and sort of all hours of the night and whatnot. And,
mm.
and the sense I get every time I talk to him is that the administration just keeps pushing down on top of him, and they're not really getting who he is. They're willing to pay him a little bit more money. He doesn't want more money.
He
wants to be able to coach his kids' baseball team.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
And so I think that piece of it matters a great deal. And we ought to make sure that our leaders have some understanding what it means to take care of a patient.
So maybe to wrap that into this idea of capability, I think if we help our teams feel and be capable, it means we give them enough resources, we give them good tools, and we give them latitude to take care of the patient in front of them,
right,
and open up their pajama time so they're not charting at home, and do these kind of things that give them a sense of connection. And you know, you kind of said it, it's the connection even that a scribe allows, that allows you to be present. And you know, in all your experience, I'm sure those best shifts were the ones where you connected.
Yeah.
You know, and
where I felt like I made a difference.
Right.
You know,
and
I don't feel like I make a difference when I'm documenting. You know, you hear the top of the license thing, and I don't want to say it, even though I just said it.
I've said it, and
like
I regret
now,
it immediately.
Now do I do? But
right.
Like, give me another way to talk about it. But
right.
Like being a doctor or
yeah.
being a nurse, like being a paramedic. That's what you ought to be doing,
yeah.
and that's what you want to be doing.
Yep.
And anything that distracts from that, there's got to be a way around that.
Yep.
You know. And so you talk about like team-based care. I like it.
Yeah.
Right. Really good. You know, there are all sorts of things. You know, it's not the documenting. Interestingly, in our survey, it's not the documenting so much that really gets in people's way. It's a problem. But it's the stuff like the inbox and all the stuff
yeah. mm-hmm.
that you feel like couldn't someone else. Have dealt with this normal potassium. And so it's all of that stuff that over time, like I said, 1,000 paper cuts, you know, just adds up.
Yeah, the 1,000 paper cuts metaphor is very powerful. It's visual and it's also tactile. You're like, ow, 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 until finally you get sepsis and die. And I want to kind of maybe wrap up this conversation thinking a little bit about...
I don't want to wrap this. I'm enjoying this.
Well, let's just
this.
Keep going then.
How long has this been?
Yeah, where are we? What are we at, Tom Heinver?
About an hour in, Z.
We're about an hour in?
Okay. We're an hour in?
I know. What happened?
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know, dude. Next time, we got to talk about UFOs.
That's crazy.
It's crazy,
there
right?
are so many other things I wanted to say.
Well, bring them in.
Can't I remember.
Because I just wanted to ask you about, like, nurses. Because nurses are the canaries in the coal mine
mm-hmm.
of our healthcare system, and they are dropping dead, mm-hmm. metaphorically speaking.
Yep.
And their documentation burden is ridiculous.
Crazy.
It's crazy.
Craziness.
So we have to fix that in some way by changing the requirements. So, you know, yeah, they're happy to have electronic records in that. Well, it's easy to read the doctor's handwriting. They're unhappy because they have to document that they documented that they documented.
Yeah. And then we lost the connection, right? Like, and maybe that was one of the things I really liked about emergency medicine was that...
It's a team right there.
Yeah, it's a great team. And I had a great connection with the nurses. I felt like they're the ones who kept me out of trouble.
Always.
And taught me.
Always, yeah.
Always. And then we introduced the electronic health record
And now you don't talk.
And here I don't even have to disparage any vendor because we decided to build it internally.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we weren't talking to one another.
Yeah.
And by that time I wasn't attending already, and the residents were just doing what they were told, which was to do their sign-offs, you know, using the electronic health record, but then they wouldn't follow up with a conversation with the nurse. And there's so much richness that comes from that connection, and we lost that. So there's got to be a way to get that back. I'm like the optimist type of person, but I believe that there's got to be a way that technology can help us get it back.
And electronic silos is the technical term, I guess, for this phenomenon.
Yeah.
That we all silo off, we don't talk anymore. This was one of the biggest changes I noticed when we went live at Stanford is, again, these nurses that were my friends that I used to know, that they would save my butt on a routine basis. But see, here's the thing, like it's easy to, you can shower and pander to nurses all day and say how great they are, and that's like a thing to do, right? But what about the nurse who really needs to learn something about, you know, the management of CHF that will change how she cares for patients because she's getting it wrong? It's the word doctor comes from the Latin docere, which means to teach.
To teach, yeah.
And we have lost the ability to teach nurses and to learn from nurses, to teach each other. Nurse, by the way, comes from nutricia or something, which is to nurture.
That I don't. Oh, is that right?
It's to nurture, yeah. And they're very good at that, but they are also teachers.
Put it together, right? Like, and that's the piece that once you get away from that, first of all, it's not as fulfilling,
right?
But it's not as good for the patient either. I think about those moments, and in the chief medical officer role, you see a lot of different patient safety issues, and again, complicated. You really have to figure out what happened, but breakdown of communication is a frequent
big
theme,
piece,
right?
Yeah.
And just taking a little bit of time to connect with something. Thinking about I missed an MI once early on in my, I still think about it, early on in my career. And there were a series of reasons why that happened. And all of them were around poor communication.
Yeah.
And that stayed with me. I mean, luckily, you know, the guy did fine. But it was a real lesson for me. And I feel like anything that prevents us from communicating in a real way, in a substantive way, is bad for patients, and it's bad for the people who provide care. So
that's the central premise of it. And again, what does it get back to? The central core of why we are who we are and what we're trying to do, which is connection.
Yeah.
And that
we're pack dogs, right?
Yeah, we are.
That's who we are.
We evolved our frontal, all our neocortex, purely to keep track of debts we owe each other in a tribe, names, faces, kids.
This is
the theory. One theory is that the reason we have this very advanced cortex, because pack animals can remember, even chimps and stuff, small numbers in the pack. We can remember about 100 to 150 tribal connections and keep score. Golden rule, he once took care of my kid for me. I owe him one.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And that's part of the reason, and we use the metaphor elephant and rider, elephant being our limbic, kind of emotional unconscious, makes all the decisions, but then this little guy on top of the neocortex is our rider, he's riding on the elephant. He's the one who has to explain his elephant's decision to the tribe.
Yeah.
So very persuasive and good at expressing, but we can make this guy stronger if we recognize how the mind works and recognize that we are tribal creatures who thrive on connection. And when you talk about loneliness, you're talking about a severing of it's like losing oxygen.
Yeah.
You become hypoxic. That's how humans are.
You know, isolation is another driver, actually, in burnout. One that I think we had an idea might be the case, but actually in this survey seems to be surfacing. And people feeling isolated is a real problem, right?
Yeah.
As you think you're a hospitalist, there was a time when folks used to come into the hospital, see their patients, but not only see their patients, right, the primary care doctors. They'd bump in other doctors, their specialists, they'd have a cup of coffee and all that.
Yeah.
It's been lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot about whether or not technology can fix that. Are you familiar with Fortnite?
Oh, am I familiar with Fortnite? Come on.
I've got a 13-year-old
Tom's
son.
Tom's playing it right now instead of watching the show.
That's what Tom's doing right now. Tom. I'm from Jersey.
I was born in Morristown.
Oh, really?
Yeah, where in Jersey?
I'm from a town called Oakland in Bergen County, not far.
Bergen County. My mom worked at Bergen Pines Psychiatric.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Oh,
okay.
For sure.
I knew
so my whole family's still there. And I have a younger brother, and his kids and my kids get along really well.
Yeah.
Okay? But they live in Jersey and we live in Massachusetts, so they don't get to see one another. They started playing Fortnite together.
Ah. Okay.
They have this really cool relationship now. In fact, they game me all the time, excuse the pun, because they will come and say, well, I'm playing with Tate or Aiden. And
oh, so it's like, it's okay, because so you guys are cousins.
I'm like,
right.
Screen time, but it's your cousins.
Yeah.
But the truth is, they didn't stop there. They started FaceTiming with one another,
oh, wow.
Right? So they're using technology to be deeply connected to one another. And that's pretty cool.
That's
right?
Hope.
And so I think it's possible for it to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that there must be a way that technology can sort of create that community again in some way. We have a client right now who are doing a virtual... like, what was it called? A physician room?
A lounge.
Lounge.
Yeah.
Wasn't coming to me.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to figure out a way to connect people through this virtual lounge. It's a pretty interesting concept.
This is fascinating because what we found, it was interesting because I worked at two hospitals for most of my career. And one was a place called Washington Hospital in Fremont, California. And that was a community hospital. Mm-hmm. And then we would rotate back to Stanford. Washington Hospital, being a community hospital, everybody kind of knew each other. There was a lounge, physician lounge, that was big. It had a big TV and a coffee machine and snacks.
Yeah.
And every single doc would station themselves there. There were computers so they could chart, but we were still on paper. But you could look at labs on the computer.
Yeah.
So it was perfect. You could use the computer for what doctors want, which is to acquire data. And then paper was an easy way to input data mm-hmm. because it's mm-hmm. incomplete. You don't have to do that much.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't ideal from a patient's quality standpoint, but it was great from a usability standpoint. And what ended up happening was all these connections. So, hey, you know, bed five, Mrs. Jane, you know, what do you think? You know, I know you wanted a catheter, but I'm really thinking she has GERD because the more I talk to her, and that sitting there, he would go, well, if you want me to catheter, I'm like, well, I need your help. I need your intuition to tell me, am I missing something? And he's like, okay, I'll go look at her with that in mind. And he comes back and says, it is GERD.
Yeah.
You're right, and I wouldn't have thought of it if you hadn't told me this and this. That just changed an outcome.
Oh man, that makes me think of the 80 million to 140 million ED visits, right?
Yeah.
Because when we're so pressured for time and we're clicking along, you don't get that kind of leisure
luxury.
Time.
It's
a luxury to have some leisure time to just think with a colleague around what's happening with this patient.
Absolutely.
Right?
So can technology give us the leisure time back by taking some of the stuff off our plate, by making us more efficient in other ways? That's the million-dollar question.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so, actually. Yeah. I do. I'm not a Luddite. You know, people are like, you're always railing about EMRs. I'm like, no, because I want them to be better.
Yeah, good.
Yeah,
yeah, be angry. You should be angry.
Yeah.
We should all be angry, I should say.
Don't worry, they are.
Oh, they're pissed.
Oh, yeah. They're going to find you on the street, Kevin Band.
Exactly. You don't publish my address, right?
Maybe. Tom, scratch the address from the...
But yeah, I mean, I think you should have high expectations. There are all sorts of excuses like meaningful use and we're busy doing other things, but they're just excuses. Ultimately, as this transformation occurs and as we think more about a place where an electronic health record can empower me instead of, you know, getting in my way, we need to be creative and push it through.
I'm excited for the future, actually. I really am. I always have been. In the depths of my burnout, I might have lost sight of it, but I'm re-inspired because I get to meet people like yourself, like people who are working in companies from the inside trying to make everything better. Were there any other things you wanted to share with us, Kevin, while you're here?
Oh, geez. what else can I tell you? I feel like, gosh, we've been going at this like for over an hour.
No, we'll have to have you back because this
I'd love to come back. I've actually really enjoyed this. I was a little nervous up front.
Were you?
Yeah.
Why? We're just us.
We didn't know one another.
That's true. We've never met.
And so we've talked before.
Right.
But we don't know one another. And
right.
And now I kind of feel like, hey.
You know what's interesting? We get to know each other in real time on the show. Like people are watching connection form in real time because we only chatted briefly before the show.
Yeah.
So this to me is a really interesting thing because if you guys wonder like how do two colleagues, and we are colleagues, I'm a hospitalist, you're an emergency doc, we admit to, you know, you admit to me, I come down and yell at you.
You come down and yell at me.
And... right. But really we're brothers from other mothers, right?
Yeah. No, actually it's the concept of like-mindedness.
Yeah.
And I cannot be connected to enough like-minded people.
Yeah.
I always learn a lot, like I have just in this conversation
with you.
I mean, it's genuinely a conversation and relationship I'd like to continue. This is the type of stuff that matters, and maybe it's in some ways demonstrative of what we're talking about in general, about what healthcare lacks a little bit.
I think you nailed it.
But so I think I was a little freaked out up front, but I feel pretty good about it now, and I'd love to come back.
You're a pro. I'm really impressed, Kevin, and I've learned a lot, and I'm glad that someone like you is in a leadership position, and I'm glad you're continuing to do great things, and I'm excited. And I'm also excited to have you back. So next time you're coming through Vegas, let me know.
You got it.
And we'll talk about Italy. I want to talk about being a television news personality, and there's a whole list of things I want to ask you about.
Cool.
So Dr. Kevin Bann, Chief Medical Officer of Athena Health, emergency physician, former Harvard faculty, and all-around amazing guy, thank you for being on the show, man.
Thank you.